Hello and welcome to Flight to Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast who's down there in the darkness, in the pipeline, waiting. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
And I'm a pit of seaweed with hypnotic potential for this episode.
I thought you'd done something with your
name. I had. Do you like it? Yeah. Might catch on.
And that means we are back with the last part of Season 5 of Doctor Who, talking about two classic stories, Fury from the Deep and The Wheel in Space. So we'll start off by the seaside with Fury from the Deep.
Bloody seagulls at it again.
So, this is my one, I think.
It is.
And can I just update us on the missing stories status? We have 9 recons to go, I think. This is the last completely missing story.
Hooray!
In Doctor Who's history. There are little bits and pieces of it still left. It's a lot of violent excised clips, excised from, you know, by the ABC censors,
yes.
And then
yes.
Rediscovered by Damien.
It's important to note that Damien Shanahan is obviously a schlock horror collector and that his entire vault at home must be full of the most horrendous things.
People being stabbed.
Exactly. He is the too many cooks auteur of Australian television.
We'll put that in the show notes if you have no idea what we're talking about. So in our last episode, but one, I think I went on and on and on about how much I dislike
the massacre.
Yes, yeah. But also the base under siege as an idea.
Oh, right.
And early on this season, you know, I was pretty convinced that what we were essentially getting was, you know, a whole heap of pretty interchangeable concepts. So you would have intransigent base commander, you would have a base somewhere, you would have people in stupid costumes, you know, menacing the base.
A helicopter.
A helicopter.
Phone.
Yeah, the BBC phone machine. And so this is one where I had never seen it before, the podcast, and I don't think I'd listened beyond episode 1 of the soundtrack. So this was quite a new experience, and I was completely ready to absolutely hate it. You know, it had the foam machine and all of those sorts of things, and I just thought it was going to be completely terrible. And it does start out like it might be terrible. And I guess the worst thing about it is Robson, where you now have... We've had a series of base commanders, haven't we, from General Cutler to Leader Clem.
Right.
To...
So what's different about this one? So it's a base under siege, but where is it? What's happening with this
one? So we're in the present day, although it looks nothing like the present day.
So we're back here.
We're back on Earth. We turn up by the beach. There's oil refineries. A lovely
Does he strip
beach.
Off again and come and have a swim?
That is
Who'd have thought that'd be happening?
In fact, well, they don't land on the beach. They land in the water, which thanks to the War Games, we actually have that landing clip, and it's a fantastic piece of model.
So the TARDIS floats. What happens in the Time Meddler? Do they all actually have to go and bungee out to sea to get back into the TARDIS in that case?
I don't know. Yeah, because
the tide came in.
Yeah, the tide came in, but it's still there. It's still where it was. He engaged the time anchor.
I refuse.
You just made that up, didn't you?
I did.
Yeah.
Hey, Stephen Moffat, give me a call. I can write for you.
I'm going to quote Derek Sherwin a lot today on what he talks of the 60s producer and what he says. I may not mention exactly what he says about the current era. But anyway.
Because we can't have the explicit tag, maybe.
Well, maybe. We can just use acronyms. But this is... I really like this story. You've come to like it now. It's kind of like an oil rig thing, isn't it? They're out on this, before the Zygons, they're out on this rig thing, and there's something going on. They're refining, so there's obviously a mutant, spooky, ooh, don't drill under there because you know what will happen in Inferno. It's actually making the whole Pertwee era look a little bit, you know. Are you getting the point now? Brendan Nathan, at this point of the show, that we didn't actually ever need colour because every story has been, you might say ad nauseam, but every story has been analysed and promulgated before we even get to the 70s. Everything, even the war machines, is giving us stuff that Tom and later Peter Davis and all the others are going to do really well.
I had always thought there was like a massively bright line between the 60s and 70s, and it was partly because the 60s are in black and white, and partly because we don't have it all, and partly because, frankly, I was just not really particularly familiar with it. But now, and next year in season 6, you can really, really see how this is sort of working towards the Pertwee era. And this could have been in season 7, yeah, quite honestly. It's very like Inferno.
And a lot of that is Derek Sherwin, who's now script editing and taking over from, there's some amazing behind-the-scenes stories of what wasn't working out, which is why you get really interesting ideas with really what ideas, as we're about to discover.
Yeah, well, he lasts into 1970, doesn't he?
Absolutely. So far. He produces Spearhead from Space, Derek Sherwin.
Yeah.
And
the BBC removed
Spearhead from Space.
It's a terrible acting performance. So
with no lines.
He'll get to that because he fires a bloke who's actually doing the job.
Shockingly bad. So we have another base commander. He's called Robson, which is only really one letter different from the base commander in the moon base. This base commander, he's going to be intransigent because we need the base commander to kind of delay the resolution. You know, normally the base commander doesn't recognise what's going on until the last possible moment. This guy's just horrible, though. Like, he's like really rude and mean to everyone. I don't know, like, you know, what passes for kind of management training in the in this sort of oil company, but he belittles people and yells at them. He refuses to slow down the machinery in the event of, you know, any kind of problem. He's really just angry and abusive for no reason at all.
His character makes a very good point about capitalism in business, because whenever anyone challenges, not necessarily him directly, but when Van Lutyens is talking to Harris and they're talking about, you know, can't we get him removed, get someone else in, the response is always, oh, but he's been on the rig for ages and he brings in results and that's why they haven't got rid of him. So, you know, it's a very good point of, you know, people need this gas for power and whatnot. So the people getting the gas, they don't really matter just so long as the little black rocks make the television work.
Yeah, yeah. So he could be like a hideous, abusive half-wit. And so by the end of episode 2, I have to say that I wasn't hopeful. Like, I thought that this was essentially going to be what we've been having all year. But I think that I have to concede your point from a little while ago. I think it was 2 episodes ago, or maybe even last episode, where you, Brendan, said that although we had the base under siege template and it was happening over and over again, what mattered was the sort of variations in the different characters, and even little details of the setting. But we had different characters in these base under siege stories. And here I think the characters are really terrifically successful. So you mentioned Harris, who is just lovely. He seems to be just a thoroughly nice man. You know, he's very mild-mannered. He contrasts really well with Robson. He has a wife, which is like a weird, rare sort of human touch.
Yeah, we don't often see interpersonal relationships.
Well, it was a deliberate thing in this one to try and make it more like Russell later did with 1,000 Years Later. It's a soap within a show. You've got a real couple having real arguments and all the rest of it. And it's nicely done as a setup for what's going to happen with Victoria.
So the
whole kind of thing. Victoria's probably at her whiniest in this one too, isn't she? You get the point when she keeps saying, you know, why do we always end up in these awful places with the terrible things? Do you think the TARDIS, the whole reason for this series and all these repetitions of Base Under Siege, that there's a pattern, do you think the TARDIS is trying to do her in?
Yeah, it's trying to get rid of her.
Yeah, it really is.
The thing is, I do find Victoria quite whiny in this one, but I feel that she earns it in this one because right from the very beginning, you know, she gets knocked out, she holds it together, she's picking locks with bobby pins.
Yeah, she suddenly has abilities of, you know, 70s spy girls who are later going to come up, and she's science-y and smart. And
she actually always was a little bit science-y, you know what I mean?
Yeah, there's all these subtle references that she was getting up to things that her father didn't know about. You know, she knew how to make stink bombs, for instance.
Yeah,
she knows how to pick a lock. And then when we look back at her first story, she gets along really well with all the servants. You have this wonderful image when you get to the end of Victoria that actually she's never been really the Victorian miss. She puts that on as a persona, but actually, you know, she, instead of going to school, she was running hooky with the servants.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder whether she's quite as carefully characterised as that. But this, I think, is the first time properly that you've had the departure of a companion seeded all the way through the story.
And it's very well
thankful.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so, So, you know, normally what happens now is if someone's leaving in Doctor Who, in modern Doctor Who, the story becomes about that to a large degree, or it's a giant event and then we get it sort of properly dealt with at the end. Hitherto, like in the 60s, we've just had terrible companion departures where they've just been sort of written out mid-story or, you know, sort of wandered off and never seen again. And I guess the high point previously has been Ian and Barbara's, which wasn't seeded. I mean, they were already in the present day in their own time earlier on in that story.
Yeah.
But it's so heartfelt and it's so beautifully done that it really is, I think, the best companion departure to date. But this would have to be the second best one. And it is because the way that her discontent with her way of life with the Doctor is seeded all the way through. There are a few conversations she has also with Jamie and all of that sort of thing about how scary and difficult all of these bases under siege are.
Yes.
And
honestly, you'd think someone would have teeth for me.
How about right at the end that you get the whole apotheosis for a reason she's there? It's the scream, not to give anything away. The scream is the thing that makes it. She's the monster.
Yeah.
It's not really a monster, it's Hedora, the Godzilla monster, yeah, isn't it? This is a Godzilla movie. If you look at the plotting and the way the whole thing's set up bit by bit, just watch any of the 60s Godzillas and you know where this is coming from.
And especially with what Richard just mentioned, I do recommend, even if you haven't seen a Godzilla film, watch Godzilla versus Hedora. Godzilla vs. Hedora is so different from every other Godzilla film because it's got an environmental message. Mm. Like, a lot of the Godzilla films at the time, we were getting into the 70s now, just don't have any sort of message at all.
They did originally, though, didn't they?
Oh, they did. Yeah. They had an anti-war message. This was the first one with a anti-pollution message, and people these days really quite love it. But at the time, the director was told, do not darken the doors of Toho again. You have ruined Godzilla forever. Yeah. And, you know, this was after the giant lobster monster of Abira horror from the deep.
I think we've proven, like Doctor Who, you can't actually ruin the brand.
No, this is true.
It can always reboot itself.
That brings me to the problem I have with Fury from the Deep. And that is that it doesn't feel like a Doctor Who story to me. Because, of course, it didn't start as a Doctor Who story. It was a radio play that Victor Pemberton called The Slide. And it just feels like the Doctor, Jamie and Victoria had been inserted into this plot, especially in the first four episodes.
Mm.
They're all doing their own thing away from the main plot. They're investigating the problem. But the cliffhanger I referenced earlier, it's down there in the darkness in the pipeline waiting. The Doctor, Victoria and Jamie are back in the TARDIS conducting experiments on the seaweed. They're nowhere near the plot at that point.
Maybe that's why they go back to the TARDIS. They go to, do they? I think they,
well, they go to some sort of lab and the TARDIS hum is in the background. It's hard to tell, being that it's a reconstruction. But I've always envisioned that scene as being in the TARDIS.
Oh, okay.
I really like that they slide into it sideways. That's what a real story should be. They shouldn't be the centre of everything. They are supposed to be
in fact,
by episode three, though, I think they should be firmly entrenched in the plot, in my opinion.
I think they're always a bit sidelined, actually. I don't know whether it's me, but I watch these whole stories and then kind of forget what Jamie and Victoria were doing in them sort of most of the time. So Victoria resolves the plot, and I think it's a cruel sort of writerly gag about her character. She's not actually quite as screamy as she's portrayed here. She has to scream at the drop of a hat. You know, she's screaming at ventilation shafts and various other things.
She might have read the Da Vinci Code. There's a page and a half in that where Dan Brown talks about the narrative is actually driven by his description of the air conditioning in the gallery. So, you know what? This is a really great story compared to popular literature.
Oh, God, I'm now imagining Victoria and Jamie in Fifty Shades of Grey.
Why would you imagine that?
It's awful.
Who wears the skirt in this couple?
And we haven't talked about Oak and Quill either. Like, there's a whole...
That's actually the main reason this is good.
Yeah.
Davina, and they're kind of a... Oh God, it's such a weird thing, isn't it? One of them doesn't talk. The other one, it's a Laurel and Hardy kind of thing.
The other one's super camp.
Super camp. And they open their mouths and breathe out gas and kill people. And so super camp. Did you know that Pemberton wanted them to have a spin-off series?
He'd
written a Brazy, he'd written to the BBC. he thought that they were that interesting. You've got to remember Batman was doing really well still on ITV right opposite, so that kind of villain was a cool thing. Can you imagine what that would have been like?
And well, just 3 years later.
Mr. Wint and Mr. Kidd.
Actually, Diamonds Are Forever.
Pretty close.
Yeah. Well, they're both sort of gab. Are they a couple?
Well, Mr. Wint and Mr. Kidd do walk off holding hands at one point.
It's hard
to say with Mr. Oak and Mr. Quill. But
I don't think it's hard to say.
But of course, as we have discussed before, Victor Pemberton is gay.
Super
gay.
His partner at the time and for the 40 years following was David Spencer, who played Tommy.
Yep.
So it's quite possible that these two characters were envisioned as a gay couple. You know, they go everywhere together, they do everything together.
But with the parenthetic evil gay couple, because gay couples in the 60s were always evil gay couples.
Like Mr. Wint and Mr. Kidd.
So
marvelous film.
Leopold and Loeb, going back to the 20s. Oh, In Cold Blood was a huge hit just the year before and the year before. You know, Truman Capote's groundbreaking number one selling novel about, based on. But anyway, gays like killing. That's what I'm getting from this.
It's also the odd tension then that, gays like killing, but they're also the most interesting characters there. Like
the outsiders are always interesting. It's just Endora with a vengeance strategy, really.
That scene, though, I mean, and we should mention that, as we said, none of these episodes exist. But one of the scenes that was cut from the Australian broadcast on the grounds that it was too scary is the scene where Mrs. Harris gets menaced by Mr. Oak and Mr. Quill. And it is, they're repairing the stove. Like, it's so ordinary and so down to earth. And it is the sort of thing that Pertwee will, looks like it's going to do over the next few years, but doesn't in fact do. It's just a woman in her kitchen, the repairmen come in, but then they open their mouths and it's utterly terrifying. Like, the scene is really fantastic and they've got terrible English teeth and so they're even more terrifying. And it's really terrifically good. And can we talk about the weed?
I knew we'd get to that.
Yes, all of that.
60s reference.
Yes, all of these people are under the control of the weed, you know. But
so it's Doctor Who does Reaper Madness.
Exactly. And the other sort of aspects of the weed aren't quite so well realised. And the script looks like the weed is you know, going to be sort of puppet tentacle things. But clearly they can't really afford that, and so they just wheel out the foam machine again. And they basically fill Mrs. Harris's entire kitchen and the patio and stuff with foam.
Yeah, Jamie left to climb out the skylight.
But they're all talking as if it's sort of full of weed and stuff. And it's really the climactic battle where we actually get, like, weed creatures. And they're clearly just some guy in a stupid outfit with tentacle arms flailing his arms around while he's up to his sort of neck in BBC foam. It really is a fabulously surreal thing if you haven't actually seen it. It is in the recons, but if you've only heard the audio, you won't really quite get how amazingly weird it looks.
Yeah. It's one of the ones I really want to have come back because you hear about, you know, people talking about it who saw it at the time, and those that remember say that the camera and the dialogue were completely at odds. So what was going on that you saw was working against how the dialogue is carrying the story, and there was tension in that.
Right.
Okay, this is memory, but...
You know, who directed it?
Hugh David. Oh, the story goes that he was completely, you know, cranky about the scripts, and the actors worked out a hell of a lot of it in rehearsal. But that's what Derek Sherwin was now saying, and was having constant fracas with Paddy on the set about, you know, I'm an actor, you're an actor, just rewrite it if you don't like it. It was very much a rep way of working it through. But by this stage, Troughton was apparently just so tired. And, you know, he was supporting two families. And he was quite
on
that
one. And he was getting towards the end of his second production block. We'll see in the next episode of our podcast, they actually started shortening the episodes.
Because he was
so tired and he just said, I can't...
He was threatening to leave. Yeah, there were trying to do things about that, but yeah, he just didn't have the patience for it anymore, and who can blame him? 42 eps a year.
It was crazy, wasn't it? I mean, that really is extraordinary.
It's mad.
That tension sort of adds to something I do like about the story, which is the Lovecraft influence. You know, and one of the whole things about Lovecraft is being unable to pin down a specific description of what the sailor saw in the city that night. So, you know, for them to be saying, oh, you know, it's a weed monster and it's 10 foot high and this, that, the other, and then the visuals don't quite match up to that, you do begin to doubt your quality of memory, as you were saying, Richard. And it's the weird tension for me for this story. It's good and it's scary, but I don't like it as a Doctor Who story. And it's got weird things like that comedy helicopter chase in episode 5.
That's so crazy.
Sorry, not even a chase. It's just comedy helicopter flight. It's the Doctor going, oh, I think I can fly a helicopter.
There were lots of meta send-ups of themselves. I mean, it was actually written into the script after Pemberton's thing, Victoria's screams would be the weapon of destruction.
I think they'd just be mean to Debbie.
No, they actually were, and Patty called her old leather lungs because of it. So, yeah, she was... But I just like at the end of it, the final episode, they defeat the beastie, and instead of doing this big mass destruction, it just goes back into the water as it should. Everything returns to normal. And they have a lovely little sort of dinner party in Maggie's horrid kitchen.
I'm a huge fan of that, I have to say. Normally, Troughton won't stay to say goodbye and will actually sneak off with the other characters still wondering, you know, where he's gone. But here, and it's partly in order to sell Victoria's departure, we get a really quite affecting scene between Jamie and Victoria.
I cried.
Mm, it's really good.
The first time I experienced this story was listening to the audio.
Yeah.
And, I cried. I was actually sitting on the tube train in London on the way home from work, and, I cried.
I really didn't. And I wonder if that had something to do with the fact that you were on the tube in the UK.
That's fairly depressing anyway, isn't it? So, and then we have the dinner, and, you know, Victoria has to make her decision and things, and the dinner is lovely. And they do a great thing with Robson as well, where he sort of gets redeemed a little bit. He's a little bit more relaxed and a little bit less of a sort of aggressive idiot.
Yeah.
But he's not completely redeemed. He is still, you know, sort of annoying and dictatorial and things. So they sort of back away from, making him the good guy. You know, it's a bit leisurely and things. That works terrifically well. This, I think, at this point, might be my favourite Base Under Siege story from season 5. But I may revise that assessment by the end of this podcast.
For me, it doesn't quite work. It's oozing with atmosphere, and the atmosphere is wonderful. It's foaming with atmosphere. But generally, I just find it 6 episodes of people I'm not terribly interested in shouting at each other and trying to avoid saying the word shaft.
Do you know what we've avoided completely is... Your namesake.
Yeah, not just my namesake, my sister's namesake. My sister was born Megan Jones, now Megan Regan.
Megan Regan.
So she goes by
That's
Meg.
A cruel
She's wonderful.
Yeah, she is the best thing about the story.
And so she comes in, like, at sort of episode 3, and there's that weird, spooky scene between Robson, who has been possessed by the weed. He's under the influence of the weed. So many people in the 60s. And Mrs. Harrison there, she walks out to sea in a cliffhanger that really goes nowhere at all.
Yes.
Before Reginald Perrin.
Before Douglas Adams in the nude.
Yes.
Megan Jones comes along, and she was the grandmother in The Idiot's Lantern,
yes,
the faceless grandma in The Idiot's Lantern. Much, much later. And she also sentences Blake to exile on Cygnus Alpha.
She does too.
Yeah. But she's terrific. She's really competent and sort of fabulous. And you've had this idiot base commander, and suddenly she's replaced by a fantastically competent woman who, you know, is incredulous initially, but fair enough. But, you know, she's not an obstacle.
Absolutely.
She's quite sensible. And it is so unusual, again, we've said this before, but maybe it is becoming normal from here on in that it's not just all men and the female companion.
Yeah.
Here we have 2 female guest stars.
What you've hit on with this is that it's not the concept, because we've seen them all ronioed and many times over this season. It's what you do with them and how you interplay and put the stuff into it and how you work out the pieces that work in between. And for all those reasons that you've said, and characters and the way they develop them and just what's going on. And the sitcom level, which is just human, underneath it or parallel to it, works really well with this.
We didn't mention, just parenthetically, no one dies. All of those people come back,
yes,
and we're
yes,
all okay. Even Van Lutchens, who looks like he's going to die horribly, I think, survives.
Yes, yes, yes. He comes back.
Plenty.
That's John Abernary, isn't it?
It is.
Another
thing I've noticed in how we're reviewing this, we're actually reviewing three different versions of the same story. That's the nice thing and the interesting thing about Doctor Who up till mid-70s. I'm probably reviewing, first of all, the audios, but before that, the Target novels. The Target novel of this was written by Victor Pemberton. It's a really thicky, I think it was the thickest one that they ever did.
Yes, I think they blew out to 160.
They did. And you know what?
War and Peace.
They did. And it's pretty good. I haven't read it since it came out, but I liked it at the time. I thought this was interesting. The character development is all there. All the things you're talking about, Negan Jones, are really prevalent in the narrative.
Right.
And it's a really femme, late 60s piece of politics stuff happening here. And it's good. It's a good book. That's my memory of it, and that's why I like it. So
she's spectacular with Robson.
Isn't it lovely that we've got a text that can be viewed on in several different media and have a completely different take on it? How many other programs can offer that? Not many.
So is this Pemberton's last one?
It's his only one.
What about Pescatons?
It's his only TV one.
Yeah, he really recycles a lot of this, doesn't he? I mean, I think it's the Tom Baker's inexplicable recorder that puts paid to the Pescatons, probably.
But this is also recycled itself many times over. You know, you've got, again, the Zygons.
Yeah.
And the ontological threat.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, also, this year's Listen reminded me of a little of this one, because you don't really find out what the monster was. And I know the point of Listen is meant to be, there's no monsters, you were just imagining it. Well, what was under the blanket?
Ugly and ugly child.
children usually give it away after a while, don't they? That
yes.
Went on far too long to be just... Unless it's a very sinister child.
A very sinister ugly child.
So now for the first time in quite a while, we're back off into space onto a wheel of some kind.
The hubcap in space.
The hubcap in space. The hubcap in space is mine.
All mine.
And Nathan, I believe you've got a status report on the functionality of the wheel.
Okay, so we have episodes 3 and 6 of this,
mm-hmm.
And I watched the Loose Cannon reconstructions. And they're spectacularly good.
Oh, like, they are wonderful.
They do a really good job. So there's a sort of stupid robot in episode 1, and they animate that just splendidly well. They have CG Cybermen, and they have CG astronauts.
They have CG spheres.
Yeah, yeah. So it's really quite fun to watch. And so this is, you know, our last story. But one with sort of substantial amounts
of missing episodes. Yeah.
So everything pretty much exists next year. They've animated 2 episodes of The Invasion, which we'll talk about in our next episode.
Indeed.
And we've got Space Pirates, which is sort of more or less completely missing. But the horrors of season 4, with its no complete stories at all, they're long behind us now.
Indeed. I should just mention the animator of these sequences. Her name is Iz Skinner. And as well as animating these sequences, she has animated the special Web of Fear trailer, the one with the Doctor talking to the camera and saying, you know, if Mummy and Daddy get scared, it's okay for you to hold their hand. And she animated a trailer for The Wheel in Space in the style of the first Alien film. So we'll put up links for both of those because she does fantastic work, and especially the servo robot in Et-1. And I do want to focus on Et-1 just for now, because Et-1 is pure David Whittaker. It's the isolationism of the Edge of Destruction, the TARDIS trying to communicate with the Doctor and Jamie, the TARDIS being this mental force, having its own mental force. That's very David Whittaker. They find a food machine that puts out things in little silver cubes. That's David Whittaker. It's the Doctor and Jamie wandering about the ship just by themselves for 20 minutes.
You haven't mentioned Mercury and the Fluid Links.
Oh, Mercury and the Fluid Links,
again,
of course.
Pure David Whittaker. And also just sort of playing for time is kind of pure
yes.
David Whittaker. It takes us a long while. We expect an episode 1 cliffhanger with Cybermen in it.
Yes.
But don't get that.
Well, I do have to wonder if the audience will read that this was a Cyberman story, because the Cybermen don't turn up until the end of episode 2.
Yeah.
And even then, sort of only in silhouette when you see a hand or that sort of thing. What I found very interesting rewatching at one for the podcast was I thought, oh, you know, this is clearly an influence of 2001, A Space Odyssey. But then I discovered that episode 1 was broadcast a week before A Space Odyssey was released in the UK.
Right, yeah. And that shot of the Pan Am shuttle linking up with the Hilton Space Station was really iconic at the time, and everyone was now obsessed with slow waltzing hardware in space. So you get this whole... But at the same time, you get the frisson, or you get the duality of it being something that was feared, because it was already seen as information overload back then, even before they had apps and me pods and myself devices. And people were genuinely concerned. You read the columns in the press at the time of how much their children were going to be able to cope with this kind of thing. The robots are going to take their jobs and we're all going to have to wear... It's not necessarily an optimistic or utopian view that they're all wearing groovy op-art outfits. Most of them get killed, especially if you're a bit slow and fat in this one. You don't tend to survive very long.
Well, that was the other thing I thought was an obvious influence. Star Trek. But I then discovered Star Trek didn't start in the UK for a year.
That's right. It's not Trek, yeah.
I did have to wonder, though, because David Whittaker, I believe, as well as freelancing, was occasionally a staff writer at the BBC, I do have to wonder if he maybe saw some screeners of Star Trek.
He might have, but this is really not about Trek. Trek was actually not original in itself. It stole a lot from Rumpeltruy Orion, from the Peter Thomas scored, beautiful Bavarian TV, the go-to 60s TV thing, 64, 65. And it was also a lot more Conquest in Space, the 1950 film. This is Conquest in Space, a Willie Ley, L.E. Wire book that came out then. It's pretty much event for event the same thing, but without cyber things, but the same kind of stuff happens. And there's this whole thing of the progression and the long march forward. And any villain is a commie, and the whole thing of the long march forward is, yeah, we're getting that, you know, the future is not altogether shiny and bright and new. That people weren't that silly.
But it does, I mean, it does also just copy lots of previous Doctor Who. So if you think about the moon base has, or even the 10th Planet, actually, both of those have like a multicultural crew, you know, from all sorts of different places, and this has that. An intransigent base commander, and we've got that again in Jarvis Bennett. But I think the thing that makes this stand out is that the characters are just really good and interesting.
It's really well written.
And the other thing that makes it stand out is...
Gemma Corwin.
Well, Gemma Corwin, Tanya Lernoff.
Yeah.
And we'll come back to her,
great
obviously.
Groovy girls.
But Zoe Harris.
Duggan is great, Rico is great, Leo is great, like all of those characters.
But this is very much like Anderson's UFO, which wasn't out yet, but the supporting cast, Anne Ridler, who plays Gemma Corwin, is one of my favourite actresses of this period. She was in a show based on a Rumour Godden book called The Didikoi that came out in the 70s, and she plays the same kind of part several times over in a very short career. Anne Ridler plays these, and Whittaker loves doing this. He throws the Doctor in almost immediately with a mature and intelligent and independent, highly motivated woman, and they start flirting almost immediately.
Mary Peach.
It's just really, really... don't like that she doesn't make it to the end. It seems that if you've got the grooviest Chelsea boots and you look really good in the outfit, you survive in this story. If you've been on the putty side, who's the bloke who ends up doing a really ill-advised rumba with the Cybermats and dies about it?
Duggan doesn't
make it. Yeah, you see, Duggan.
Great.
And then he stands up and he doesn't look as good in the suit. You're going to die.
But I think I'm happy to report, Richard, that Anne Ridler lived to the very very experienced age of 89 years.
Oh, I'm so glad. But she just has such manifest glory and understated warmth and charm and intelligence in everything I've seen her do.
Guest cast always get killed in Doctor Who, and And I actually...
The wrong ones.
Yeah, no, but I think here, having a really sympathetic, really likeable character get killed ups the stakes. It upsets the Doctor, you know, like he's visibly shaken by it.
But couldn't we have had him go off with the woman he's obviously flirting with and have a really interesting year with a mature woman like Gemma Corwin, and Zoe can just stay there being kind of, you know, Ronio's proto-companion tippy-type. I love Wendy Padbury, I really love it, but...
I actually really like Zoe. I mean, Zoe is a very high-concept character when she's introduced.
Yeah,
and
she's
just,
pure SF high-concept.
Yeah, they backpedal.
We're going back to Heinlein now. Yeah.
They do backpedal from that, and she doesn't end up being like that really particularly. So
she's never a screamer, though, is she?
No.
Really. Well, she'll have a yell when she falls down a shaft.
She has a couple of screams, but she is not a screamer.
No.
Yeah. No, in fact, she's a deliberate contrast with Victoria. So she's from the future instead of the past. She's...
Because I know you love that when they're contemporaneous.
Well, yeah, no, I just find that sort of slightly irritating. But I think that I actually think that Zoe works really well because she's sort of perky and elfin and kind of likable.
Pert.
And although, you know, she's been brainwashed by the parapsychology unit and she has a head full of facts and she's like a human computer and stuff, and everyone's kind of slightly rude to her for that reason. And she
they are, aren't they? There's a nice little fist on. She's the... Actually, you're right. She's the fangirl in the way that Susan was originally the fangirl, and she's too bright for the class and the kids all pick on her because she's too... And that's for all the smart kids at home who are watching this. And you're right. I like that it's a female character because there were fangirls in the 60s. Yeah. We just didn't have names for ourselves. And she's sitting there... being a little fan and saying, I read science fiction and I'm the only one in the universe who does it.
Well, in fact, she expresses dissatisfaction and says that she doesn't want to be emotionless. And, of course, that works quite well thematically, doesn't it, with the idea that there are Cybermen. You know, the emotionless Cybermen are lurking outside.
Yeah. And on the other hand, you've got the incredibly emotional but pretending he's logical Jarvis.
Oh, now this is crazy. So we're in the 10th planet. We had the Cybermen contrasted with General Cutler, who was massively emotional and put everyone's lives at risk.
Actually, so.
Yeah, yeah. Here, Sandifer suggests that maybe it's a sort of Whitakerian kind of joke. The base commander is just literally crazy. Like, he's intransigent, not because he can't accept reality or anything, but just because he's just certifiable.
Yes, he's actually completely paranoid. He has a lot of symptoms of something called borderline personality disorder.
That was Robson. He had that in spades.
Well, borderline personality disorder, one of the things there is you are paranoid. You think that everything is out to get you.
Yeah.
And you personally. It can't affect anyone else. It's just affecting you. So whenever something presents itself that can't be explained, Jarvis takes it very, very personally. Like, no, I can't do this right now. Therefore, it's not happening.
Yeah.
And there's this wonderful rising panic about him. And I do think, we've got another mad, inflexible leader. But I think where this succeeds, where, say, General Cutler in 10th Planet didn't succeed as well, is actually in the crew. Because, as you said, they're a multinational crew. And by multinational, pretty much they're still all coming from Europe and the colonies. But at the same time, the crew is roughly half men and half women. And with the exception of Jarvis and possibly Bill Duggan, they're all these bright young things whose eyes are open to new ideas, whereas Jarvis Bennett is the old guard. He's like, no, I will run this station how I've always run this station because it's been working perfectly well for 50 years and why should I change it now? Whereas...
From my very comfortable position with my ass really firmly pressed into this rather comfy leather armchair space thing.
No, I just think he's an idiot. Like, he's
he is an idiot.
Yeah, and that's actually kind of boring. Why do we still get 2D? Ah, you know, it's Kane Mutiny, it's all this stuff right back to Moby Dick, Commanders, and lots of folk. Don't forget the mums and dads watching this, or the dads especially. A lot of them were in the war, at least in that effort, when they were young lads. They all had controllers and commanders like this. They all had, you know, subalterns like this. And they remember that most things go wrong because of bad decisions by people in leadership. So it's just something that people took for granted as a dumbass thing.
For me, it's a very political point because when I used to be a teacher in the UK, one of the things that greatly frustrated me was the education minister there at the time kept coming out and saying things like, well, you know, the system's not working and, it can't possibly be working because this is happening and I don't like what's happening here. And it just always amazed me that it's not just him, but education ministers the world over say, The system isn't working. The system that educated me to the point where I could become a government minister isn't working.
Yeah, because he went to Eton.
Yeah. So, you know, Jarvis is like, we must maintain the system the way I maintained it, despite the fact there's been all these advances and there's all these new people coming through, but they can't possibly have any good ideas.
You'd think this was made this year, wouldn't you?
Well, it's a timeless thing.
Really, yeah, conservative in its politics. Yeah.
Good leaders, i.e. Gemma Corwin, who is in a position of power in the station, don't try to shoehorn facts to fit their worldview. She, for instance, accepts, okay, there are these two people who are obviously lying. She says, I believe Jamie was lying, but reluctantly. And she lists all the things he's lying about. And she's like, I don't think he's dangerous, but there's some reason that he's lying. Whereas Jarvis immediately goes, right, well, they must be stowaways and they must be here to sabotage us. And Jenna's like, no, I don't think that's it. But that's the only thing that fits his worldview rather than actually looking at what's going on around him. And I think that's why the characters in this are so successful, because they've each got their own worldview and it informs their actions.
I also think the pacing of it helps, because you've got episode one, which is just, you know, 20 minutes of faffing about, as we said.
Yeah.
But then the Doctor has a lovely holiday in episode two while he's unconscious, and Jamie gets introduced to the base characters and they have to carry it. And
Fraser carries the episode really well on his own.
But it's not really on his own, because you have this strong ensemble of characters that all get introduced. And so by the time Gemma dies, we know her really well. By the time Bill Duggan dies, we know him. He collects plants. Everyone thinks he's slightly crazy, you know.
Yeah.
I think all of that stuff is terrifically effective. Mm. The worst person, though, and the most embarrassing moment is Chang. You said everyone was from Europe. There's a man called Peter Laird who plays Chang. And, like, the accent is just absolutely, like... Oh, clenchingly, you know, embarrassing.
I think that's why I'd forgotten him.
It's so bad. It's so unbelievably awful. But fortunately, he's killed quite quickly, so we don't have to put up with him for very, very long.
Yeah, Donald Sumter being browned up to kind of look a bit Mediterranean wasn't that great to start with, but yeah.
Who was that?
Rico.
But Rico is such a sweet character.
Well, yeah, I mean, it helps that he is not played as a stereotype.
No, he's not. Like Tito, whatever his name
Tito
is.
Tito in the 10th Planet.
In the 10th Planet.
Whoa, I am Natalia. That was pretty bad.
He's lovely. And the other thing we haven't mentioned is Leo and Tanya have this sort of growing romance. Which there are no scenes about the romance, but just gradually. Oh, maybe
it's just all in the performance. It's all in the actors' performances.
By the end of it, they're draped all over each other and things, but it's really warm and a little bit grown up in the sense that, you know, it's not just a whole bunch of men. You know, it's people with relationships, like we saw in Fury from the Deep with Maggie and Mr. Harris.
Mm. We must have a first name, but I can't remember what it is.
Did we get any of this in Power of the Daleks with the old... With Chan Wei and... I think Whitaker tries to flesh out his characters, but I'm trying to think... Because Sherman was also really determined to get this show, get the ratings back and actually get this to be a popular thing again.
In Paradox, we also had Dr. Fane, because I was going to say, the thing with Jan Lee was she's painted as villainous because she uses her feminine wiles to lure men into stupid plans. But Dr. Fane is a far more balanced character. She's still involved with the rebels, but she has a conscience about it, and la-di-da-di-da. Certainly, Whitaker has always been a master of characterization. Faria. Who we talked about last episode.
Well, all of those characters.
We should just have a whole podcast for Korea.
Well, in fact, let's just talk about Enemy of the World again.
That's the good stuff.
Can we talk about the Cybermen then? I can see you segueing towards the Cyber Plan.
Whether I really dislike Wheel in Space because David Whittaker just suddenly has some contempt for astrophysical concepts, or if I really love it because it very aggressively goes, who needs science? Screw that. We're going to have fun. We're going to blow up a star several light years away and it's going to affect us instantly because screw you, that's why.
Yeah, no, it's crazy, isn't it? So the Cybermen here, they don't actually get much dialogue and there aren't very many of them. And you know, we've had
Cybermen... What do you mean? There's loads of them when they do their spacewalk into the mirror.
Yeah. But they don't talk to us. It's not like they take over the base and start moralising at us.
Which is good.
Yeah, so they lurk and they're sort of scary. And they're under the control of a kind of light bulb in an evening frock, aren't they? The cyber controller. And
the cyber planner. Yeah,
the cyber planner, really?
Yeah.
Is that it?
Yeah. Real name Pam Poovey.
Yes, I can see that happening. It's a very bizarre-looking thing, and there just seems to be one shot of it. Oh, it's a recon, that's why I think that. I'm sure it was directed very thrillingly.
Yes. Yeah, as thrillingly as you can direct a light bulb inside a metal frame.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's an interesting idea because earlier this year we had the Cyber Controller for the first time, so that was a new concept.
Wait, where, what?
In Tomb of the Cybermen.
Oh, do you mean Michael Kilgariff with the big transparent brain?
Yes, that's right. And, you know, obviously at that point they couldn't bring him back because they destroyed him and he never, ever, ever comes back again, 1985. So instead we have this new idea of the Cyber Planner. It's also a total new design for the Cybermen. It's new helmets and new suits.
But they don't have the tape around their mouths.
They don't have, and they've got the little sort of tear ducts.
Well, the teardrop, which is, you know, was actually one thing that Russell insisted. He said, look, you know, design the Cybermen how you want, but they must have the teardrop. Mm. And in fact, I think it is the Wheeling Space Cybermen because they're going to get stupidly redesigned for the invasion. We'll talk more about that next time. But this is the version of the Cybermen that is familiar to us now. This is what the Cybermen essentially look like in modern Doctor Who.
Absolutely. And the second redesign, starting with Nightmare in Silver and most recently seen in Dark Water, Death in Heaven, is based heavily on this Wheeling Space, very slick.
Yeah.
Sort of straight up and down, wetsuit. Instead of the big hoses they had in the moon base and Tomb of the Cybermen, it's now just little hydraulic tubes.
Yeah. But I mean even Russell's ones. And Russell insisted that the teardrop be there. And that was because he wanted to emphasize that they were human beings that had been sort of brutally robbed of their emotions and things.
Yes,
so that teardrop thing stays. But their voices are almost incomprehensible. I think they have like two different kinds of voices depending on whether they're on film or on videotape. None of that's very, very good.
Yeah.
And so their plan is to blow up stars many, many light years away to divert meteorites on. In fact, their plan is just crazy, isn't it?
Yeah,
so they send Cybermats to eat the bernalium,
so
which they need for the laser.
Yes.
And then they bring the silver carrier there and put bernalium on it. And,
so the Cybermen can attack them and mind control.
The Cybermen hide in the crates full of bernalium, which get brought across from the silver carrier. The whole thing is just mental, and then they're diverting asteroids with explosions that wouldn't actually be visible from Earth for several years.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean?
Yes, exactly.
If you calculate, hang on, it's 25,000 light years away. Messier 13.
Yeah.
25,000, 30,000 light years away. She's got the bestest telescope. This is Carl and Zala having it out when it exploded. And Eileen Way was saying, you put that light out.
It's crazy.
And you know, then on top of that, the actual reason they're doing all this is to destroy W3 or cripple W3 so that way they can go down to Earth and take a drink, plunder it for its mineral wealth.
What's W3?
The space wheel. It's wheel three. It's the third wheel of, I believe, six.
So they should have called it the fifth wheel. That would have been better. But that just reminds me of 3W from Death in Heaven. Is that coincidence?
Oh!
Possibly.
Yeah. I hadn't thought of that because
we still don't know what the 3W meant in Death in Heaven.
Yes, you mean three words.
Spoiler alert.
I've seen the whole
thing. What about these people out here?
They've all seen
it. It's been on television, all right. By the time we're recording.
It's don't cremate me.
The three words are don't cremate me. I mean, that all turns out to be a bananas scheme by Mary Poppins.
Another banana scheme in the great tradition.
But yeah, it's just... It's a Rube Goldberg machine of a scheme from the Cybermen. You know, all these little bits have to work when really all they had to do was
go onto the wheel with their guns and kill a bunch of people.
Even if they wanted to do all the other stuff, they didn't need to explode the star and send the meteors in. All they needed to do was go, okay, we'll send the Cybermats over, eat the Banalium, then we'll ram the Silver Carrier into the space station.
It's still just stupid.
It's still stupid, but at least that way it's less stupid. And that's the thing, you've got all this great characterization, but you've got this great characterization fighting an utterly bizarre plot.
It is bonkers, isn't it? But I think it's still... I think it still works, do you know what I mean? I think it's still really entertaining, and the characters are just great, and all of that. I don't worry, you know, like, I don't mind too much about how silly the plot is, really. I mean, if you're worried about that, then you probably really want to watch another show.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it is highly enjoyable, and I like it far more than I like Fury from the Deep, because it is enjoyable. I just feel it. It's just strange. It could have been better. I understand why people don't like this story, but at the same time, I am someone who will always take a fun Doctor Who story with a stupid plot over a Doctor Who story with a good plot but no charm.
Yeah.
You know,
it's weird if
I
so it's got lots of charm.
Can I mention the massacre at this point?
Oh, if you must.
Yeah, you see, that's a good Doctor Who story with charm. Richard, you were saying.
I'm thinking of the listener at this point. It's got expression, you know, it's got character. How would I say, don't read the Target novel, because it was a sort of a later thing. I don't think it really held up that well. It was one of those ones done at a rush at the time of the 80s when they were selling the show to the US, and it was... kind of, you know, why it's not done with the density and purpose that some of the other Target novels were done.
Do we know who wrote it?
I think it was...
It was Terrence.
Yeah, it was Terrence. Yeah, I don't remember it being that great.
Yes, it was written by Uncle Terrence.
Yeah, but it was one of his ones done in a rush. It wasn't... It's not bad. It just doesn't expand the story.
Only 23,000 copies of the paper book edition were circulated, reportedly due to stocks being destroyed in a warehouse fire.
So I'm doing quite well with my issue, aren't I?
It's actually quite a rare book.
Hurrah!
Okay. You know, so you can
I'll treasure that.
You can get $10 for it instead of $2 on eBay. There you go.
I like the bit where the doctor proposes to give Jarvis Bennett ECT.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we haven't mentioned the sexual air supply.
Sexual air supply. Well, yeah, he was looking at Dr. Corwin when he said that.
He was too.
Something I found about the servo robot, and specifically the animation done by Iz Skinner, it reminded me of Wally. And not Wally in particular, the robot Wally from the film Wally. The gopher robots of the ship had the little shoulder lights like the servo robot does and had the sort of awkward motion. So I don't know if Pixar saw a picture of the servo robot or if Iz Skinner went, oh, I like Wally, I'll bring some of that into there. But I love any sort of intertextuality like that, even if it is just imagined. So, you know, folks out there, if you like Wally, you will love Iz Skinner's animation of the servo robot.
It is very cool.
Yeah. She's even got a little blemish on the back of its head where there's a blemish on the original prop.
Yeah.
It's so well done.
Wendy Padbury was offered this role for a year or a film role. And she took this one because apparently Paddy had been a childhood hero of hers, and the idea of working with him for a whole year was really exciting, probably a bit more money. The film would have been with Maggie Smith, and it was The Pride of Miss Jean Brodie.
Oh.
She just turned 20. She was going to be one of the students. Can you imagine her doing the accent? Are you doing it now?
Well, she's just so charming from go to woe with this, isn't she?
I know, we're so positive about everything. Like I say, she was horrid and drunk all the time and just a wheelbarrow for coke and used to slide her down the stoop down the white studio floor. The only reason the first episode of Mind Robber is painted white is that it covers up all the freaking powder all over the time. Wendy's flaring mono nostril because she burnt the rest of her face off. But actually, she's really sweet.
She's
so I can't say any of that. She's really lovely. And...
That's outrageous.
I just put a bit of chiaroscuro into this. But
yeah.
No, actually, everyone is bloody lovely. And it makes you sick, doesn't it? It's like getting too much white icing off the Christmas cake. There's no one in this I dislike. The cast is fantastic in this, yeah.
Do you think she's an improvement over Victoria?
Not at all. I think she's just fresh and new and different. I see nothing wrong. We should actually say cheers to Victoria and to Debbie and say, look, I actually don't think she's as bad as everybody likes to maintain.
No,
repetition. Lazy producers, lazy script editors. She gets a great new rush when Derek Sherwin comes in and she actually sits there and says, I've been whining all this year because it's been bloody awful and we keep getting dumped into the same awful situation. I'm only a little girl. Still a little girl now, and it's nothing great's happening. And I'd like her to say, and you did this to your granddaughter, and you're doing it to me, and you know what? You can bugger off. It's a great way to end it.
Yeah, she does act really well in that.
She's fine. There's nothing wrong with Debbie's performances at all. She's a good little actress in all of these shows, and she's been given a bad shrift by fandom in the intervening years.
And something that I think really becomes clear in Fury from the Deep, while we're sort of saying goodbye to Victoria, is... really, all the way through, all Victoria has been looking for has been a new family.
Exactly. And all the Doctor and Jamie did was to pull her bloody pants down before they left the TARDIS every damn story.
But, that's outrageous, isn't it?
But they did.
No, they really did.
They skirted the poor woman every time. No one said you can all bugger off.
In most stories this season, she finds...
That's not what nice brothers and fathers do.
No. She finds a familial relationship with someone. Like, she's like a little sister with Tommy... She watches the family relationship of the Travers in The Web of Fear. And then in this, you know, she sees an opportunity to have that familial relationship that was cruelly torn away from her when we first meet her. And she's been incredibly strong the rest of the time. You know, yes, she does scream when she gets scared, but it's a wonder she hasn't had a complete
breakdown
by this point. It's a great testament to the character. And unlike, say... the character of Nyssa much later on, where due to the nature of the program, they never really harked back to the fact that she'd been through this massive trauma. It's always just under the surface with Victoria. You can see in Debbie Watling's performance that she's kind of just holding it together, especially in Enemy of the World, where, you know, she tries to be all happy and, oh, we had this pudding and it was lovely. She's utterly crushed when Griffin turns around and tells her what a stupid idea that is. Because she's looking for that familial relationship.
Yeah, that's a nice point.
She was friends with all the servants. Griffin's a servant. She tries to set up a friendship with him and just gets totally rebuffed. And here she meets two wonderful people who are like, actually, we could do with a daughter figure. Please come and live with us. And she's like...
I actually think that they look somewhat surprised and horrified that she's decided that she's... It's kind of like...
It's done pretty rudimentarily and hurriedly, isn't it? It does kind of just, oh, I like it.
No, I think Maggie Harris is going to have a quiet word with the husband later when Victoria leaves the room and says, you know, can't we put her out with the Sulo bin this upcoming Wednesday? I think it's very nice of you. It's very sweet of you to say that, such nice things about Victoria. I actually think that she's vastly thinner as a character than we've had before. And she's a bit forgettable. And she does have moments of charm, but I was a bit sick of her by the end. And I have to say she is redeemed by being given some good material in Fury from the Deep. But it is a relief, I think, when Wendy comes along.
I certainly think Wendy is far better catered for by the scripts. All this stuff I'm getting from Victoria's performance and Victoria's characterization is coming from Deborah Watling.
Yeah.
And I think Deborah Watling, possibly more than anyone else in Doctor Who, takes a character who is very thin on paper and really tries to flesh her out. The success of Victoria is not in the scripting, it is in the performance.
Well, it just seems to me that the writers... overall aren't really interested in giving her a character very much.
Yeah, they're not.
Yeah.
And, you know, putting her in that stupid frock in Tomb of the Sidemen, it tells you right away that we're only really very, very vaguely invested in the premise of what she is. She really just serves a plot function, and she's there to be menaced by monsters, and she does that admirably well, but she's not very interesting as a person, I think.
However, nowadays... Debbie Watling is immensely interesting whenever you see her at conventions or talking because she's really out there.
She's really hilarious.
And she's open and funny about what happened during her time on the show. She's come back to do Big Finish.
Yes, she does.
She's done an excellent Big Finish with Colin Baker, catching up with Victoria in the 80s, where she's an anti-nuclear energy campaigner.
Really?
And she and Colin Baker actually bounce really well off each other. And, of course, when she gets to meet Perry, Perry's like, Oh, so did you know Jamie?
That's cute.
Really well done. It's called Power Play.
Okay, thank you.
And, yeah, it's part of the Big Finish Lost Stories range, because apparently they were going to bring her back in one of the proposed stories of Season 23.
Oh, God. Could Season 23 have been any worse?
Stop that.
Yes.
Sorry.
Yes, it could. But we're getting ahead of ourselves. So back on Zoe.
This is the shortest season of the show so far. I think it's like 40 episodes. And am I right?
I think you're right.
It's 40
episodes.
No, it didn't feel that short at all.
I think if more of them existed, it would feel longer.
Yeah.
Shorter.
One of those. And all these sort of padded six-parters and things. But one of the things that they do to kind of make up the numbers is they have a repeat of Evil of the Daleks at the end of the season. So this season ends with the same story that the previous season had ended on. And they actually, just in the most amazingly bizarre twist, they give it an in-season explanation.
Yes.
And so the Doctor, Zoe stows aboard the TARDIS, and before the Doctor agrees to take her away, he says, well, I'll have to show you the kind of thing that you're in for. And then he mentally projects onto the TARDIS scanner
Evil of the Daleks,
the episodes of Evil of the Daleks. And we'll find next episode of the podcast and the first episode of Season 6, the Doctor arrives on a mysterious planet and he's exhausted from the projecting all the mental images. It's very strange.
Not only that, but when they showed episode one the following week, over the first scene, there was a little voiceover by Patrick and Wendy.
Oh, really?
It's sort of saying, oh, Doctor, where are we? Well, Zoe, this is London in 1966, and the TARDIS has just been stolen. Let's watch.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's spectacular. So it's not really a repeat, is it? It actually does fit into the continuity at that point.
It's diegetic.
It is.
As Carol would say. Right, so I suppose it's time to get on to our Jenny Laird Awards for Most Puzzling Creative Choice.
My Jenny Laird Award's always sort of really fairly obvious, and I think I've laboured this year what I think the most puzzling creative choice is. Richard said over and over again that, you know, the show's being prepared for syndication in America, and so everything gets sort of homogenised.
Yeah. It's the 60s way of doing it. And this couple of years of the 60s, yeah.
Yeah, but for me it really just makes a terrible television. And I think they finally get it right towards the end. And they do that by injecting more human elements. But basically what I'm talking about is just the relentless parade of bases under siege. We've had one story that doesn't fit that mould this year. And essentially everything else has been the same. And just the incredible laziness with which the monsters are conceived. So there's not really anything beyond the monsters than it's a different kind of outfit this week. If you think about the way monsters work now, do you know what I mean? They tend to have a hook or a special ability or some kind of thematic resonance to them, whereas these are just, you know, scales, fur or you know, silver vinyl. And it is just incredibly lazy, and I think it makes this season a bit of a slog. There you go.
Fair enough. I think my Jenny Laird Award for Most Puzzling Creative Choice would be for Victor Pemberton, who I think he's a great asset to the show, but what it is for me is the Doctor, Jamie and Victoria's lack of involvement in the plot of Fury from the Deep and their reactionary nature in it. Now, I haven't heard the slide, but I think it is highly likely that it relates back to it was an external story brought in, but I just think they could have been more involved with the plot.
Look, I just think this season has progressively got better. I'm putting it at Sherwin and Pemberton's feet equally. They've taken stock. They've looked at the things. There was nothing wrong with the premise that Innes Lloyd was doing. He was looking at marketing and trying to raise the ratings, but it ain't working because the ratings were not growing, whatever you want to say. And it's only really now that you're getting shows that, thank you for getting back David Whittaker. This was his last one. He said, you can all bugger off. I'm disappearing somewhere.
Well, except for Ambassadors of Death.
Ish.
He doesn't complete it. But
yeah, because he was ill and old and tired and all the rest of it. Hello, Mac Hulk. Looking forward to you coming in. Yeah, kind of the inheritor of Whittaker. But, I mean, maybe we're biased, but I think fan consensus, you know how it goes along, goes along certain rails, doesn't it? In the 80s, everyone thought that this was the season, the preceding season, but the season, because they've got lots of monsters jumping about. Yeah,
they thought season 19 was good.
Yeah. Time Flight was one of the greatest stories of all time. So
is one of the greatest stories of all time.
Oh, really?
That'll be interesting if you're anyone still alive to hear us say it. So if you're asking what do I think was a puzzling decision, I think it was simply to try and do what other shows have done before. It's not really aping Batman so much as I think it, I've said it before, it is trying to do the Avengers this year. You go, what? It's totally different. But it's not. In the way that it's formulaic and procedural and repetitious, it's the Avengers. And they're going, and I think that that's a puzzling choice because the reason Doctor Who's great, and I reckon we're kind of getting this now, the reason it's still sort of going and it has... sorry, folks out there, but it's still, you know, still getting publicity and still honoured by the press and by the public is because of what Russell did in the first few years. Because, to quote Derek Sherwin, it's getting on my tits. the modern series, it is because it's indulgent and it's a little bit messy and it's a bit vainglorious in the current writing. And I think Doctor Who in this year is doing the same kind of thing for different reasons. It was amazing in the beginning because it had a gay Jewish 26-year-old woman starting a show with a gay Asian. Yeah, Verity came out later in life.
Did she?
Yeah, she did.
Why did no one tell me?
Didn't you know?
No.
She was really quite open. By the time she was doing Rock Follies in the 70s, she was out. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and then you've got, and you had a gay Asian director and an Australian writer, right, for the first one. Thank you, Anthony Copeland. So, you know, it was really progressive right in the day. And they've forgotten by this stage why it was amazing. And Paddy's going, come on, I liked it for the reasons that you were doing things that we didn't expect. BBC was inventive and seen as the go-to for new surprises. And now it's just trying to do what other people do for the sake of success. It's like the suits have come in, just the same thing that happened to Hollywood in the 70s and 80s. As you know, the suits take over and tell you how to make a show. No. You make a show. It took someone of Sherwin's, you know, Sherwin's guttural ability. I wanted to go a little further down the anatomy there. But to say, you know, and he's really offensive to a lot of people, and he was at the time, and he's even more so now, and I love him for it. But just saying, no, this is completely bollocks. And, you know, go with your gut instinct. Have some taste and intelligence. So it's getting there now. So I'd say my Jenny Laird was Innes Lloyd's decisions back in the day.
I think that's the same as mine, isn't it, really, essentially? Well, that idea anyway, that Doctor Who went from being a show about exploration and a show that could do anything at all and a show that missed, you know, nearly as frequently as it hit. You know, like, there are turkeys in the Hartnell era.
Oh, yeah.
But they're trying to do something that has real ambition, whereas this has settled into a groove and just a sort of depressing, xenophobic kind of groove as well.
Mm.
I hate the show. Let's do another podcast.
Well, moving hastily on to our recommendations. For me, I mentioned them earlier. I'm going to recommend Is Skinner's animations revolving around The Wheel in Space and The Web of Fear. Yeah, she's done a few, so we'll put those up on our website as my recommendation related to this season.
Well, people might not know this about me, but I'm actually a little bit of a Doctor Who geek, and I know, you know, like I'm interested in the minutiae of Doctor Who. I have a podcast where I talk to some of my friends about it.
Shock and awe.
It is a bit of a thing. And one of the resources that I've used, and, you know, ranging from, ooh, what else has that guy been in, or, you know, even, you know, preparing for the podcast, which it's hard to believe from the finished product, but I actually kind of do that. Is wikia.com. Do you know that? It's like a group of websites that just sort of rabid fans create a little subdomain, and this one's tardis.wikia.com.
I think I've heard about that on the electric internet.
Yes, and it has. It's a website on the internet, and it has all of this sort of terrifying information about all of the sort of history of Doctor Who and things and audios and books and things that I'm just never going to bother to read. And it's really interesting. It's got lots and lots of information, and they have an app as well. There's an app for it, which is quite well designed, and it will send the pictures and text from the website to your electric telephone. Yeah. It's handy and can be used at all.
Intra-Rossiter crossover network device.
That's it. You can use it at the bus stop if you're, you know, uncertain of Mel's last name, for instance, or
it's Pallister, isn't it?
Or how many episodes in The Massacre, hint 28. So I can recommend that, and I'll put links to it in the show notes.
Yay.
Do you have a recommendation?
Oh, Pemberton's Fear from the Deep. I keep saying just go back to the Target novels. I know, click-clack, same record, but yeah, again, we're watching these things. These are different shows that we're actually interpreting on this podcast. My go-to is still the Target novels and then the audios. So my interpretation of the shows is actually radically different from yours, from both of you.
Yes.
So we're watching the same show in different ways.
I don't understand why those Target novels are not more widely available. There are quite a lot of them as e-books on...
yes.
On
read, children and adults, don't. Listen, wait.
Yeah, yeah. There are a lot of them available on Amazon.
Yeah.
And a lot of them...
As audios?
As e-books.
Oh, okay.
And a lot as audios, but by no means all of them. And I just can't understand why they're not up.
Thankfully, the audiobooks are getting a new start next year because Audio Go, the arm of the BBC that were releasing them, which was a separate company, and then the BBC bought them, but it went under. But there's a new arrangement, and more Doctor Who Target novelisation audiobooks will be being released from January.
In fact, just this month, they released Carnival of Monsters, read by Katie Manning.
Oh, God. Right.
And it's just spectacular.
Does she do the chicken noises?
No, but she does a John impression, which is pretty good.
Her
Joe impression is amazing. You should hear it.
Wow.
Yeah, she's incredible.
Well, it is a different voice.
It is a different voice, actually. It's terrific. Anyway, that's my other pick. Can I have two picks? No. Okay, forget I said.
So before we finish up, we had a competition.
Hooray!
Oh, that's right.
We've been swamped with entries.
Entries. So many. One. We have I take that on myself. I take that as feedback that I made the entry process too complex. So
all you had to do to enter was send some cybermats to the wheel to steal the banalium.
Yep.
And then, you know, inspire the wheel people to use their laser, which obviously relies on banalium.
You had to blow up a star, preferably someone from the way.
And then you had to tweet about it, then post it on Facebook, then post it on Bebo, and then post it on Tumblr.
Not forgetting Weibo.
Weibo.
Yeah. So, you know, we wanted people to go to China. So, for our ongoing competition, all you have to do is comment on this episode on the website.
Yep, flightforentirety.com.
That's all. Just follow through to the link, go down the bottom, comment, even if you just say splunge or splink. And, splink is a very useful word. If Danny Pink had remembered to splink, we wouldn't be in this problem today.
He'd still be with us.
But as it is, we should say the winner of our episode 14 competition goes by the handle of The Hand of Fear.
Yay.
And so we'll be getting in touch with you about how you would like your Target novel delivered and which Target novel you'd like from the selection we have available. If you'd like to win a Target novel of your very own, please comment on the website and we'll be giving up to a total of 3 away each podcast. And that will be announced on episode...
Thing.
N plus one.
That will be announced on the second episode covering season 6 of Doctor Who. Speaking of season 6, as we're about to be going into that, gentlemen, your story allocations. So, Nathan, your season 6 stories are The Seeds of Death and The Space Pirates.
I don't know what to think about that. I've never seen it. It's now the only Doctor Who story that I have no idea about.
Hooray. Richard, you get 2 in a row. You get The Dominators.
Oh, pretty.
And The Mind Robber.
Yay.
Meanwhile, I will be discussing The Invasion and The Crotons. And for the final story of the War Games, because it's so big and so influential, we're just going to have a massive free-for-all on that one.
There's so much variation goes on in that story. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we will be back next week with our discussion of The Dominators, The Mind Robber, and a story I consider to be very important in Doctor Who's history, The Invasion. So until then, good night.
Yay.
Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to Flight to Entirety with Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. This episode, Too Many Cooks, was recorded on Sunday the 30th of November. The next episode will be released on December the 14th. You can find us online at flightthroughentirety.com, Flight to Entirety on Facebook and iTunes, and FTE Podcast on Twitter. I tried activating the sexual air supply once, but I was all out of love.
Oh, wait, does that mean we're recording?
Mouth full of cake.
As usual.
Here we go. Oh, sorry. Cake plates.
Ah, thank you. I was just using a coaster like an animal.
That should be in the podcast.